Hello and welcome to the IEA podcast. I'm Emma Revel, Head of Communications at the Institute of Economic Affairs, and today I'm joined by my colleague, Dr. Christian Niemitz, who's our Head of Political Economy, to talk about the entrepreneurial flourishing happening during the coronavirus outbreak. But before we get started, let me just remind you, you can subscribe to the IEA podcast however you listen to it, whether that's Apple, Spotify or Podbean. And for more of the IEA's digital content, you can visit our YouTube channel, IEA London. When we think about the impact of coronavirus on businesses and the economy, the immediate focus is on the negatives, the damage to business viability and falling consumer confidence, as well as the astonishing growth in public sector borrowing that the taxpayer will somehow have to repay. But are we missing the bright spots in the gloom? Many businesses have moved rapidly to adapt their business models to the new normal, with some really innovative responses to ensure they can keep operating during lockdown. Christian, we're having this discussion prompted by an excellent piece you wrote for the Reaction website that I'm going to link to in the show notes. What do you think are the best examples of this entrepreneurial flourishing that you've been talking about? What do you mean when you say that?
There isn't one specific, particularly spectacular example that I would single out. I would say we have just seen lots of entrepreneurial responses across the board. We have had examples such as, well, especially in the hospitality sector, restaurants and pubs to a lesser extent, shifting all their activities towards delivery and takeaway. And we've seen examples such as breweries and distilleries suddenly starting to make hand sanitizers. We've had cosmetics companies starting to make disinfectants. We've had clothing companies starting to make face masks. It's examples of that kind, shifting towards a new structure of consumer demand and just adapting very rapidly. Things that seem obvious in hindsight, but somebody has to think of them first. And then, of course, the less visible examples with a lot of most office-based workplaces shifting their entire working practices towards home working, which is no mean feat. It does mean a complete restructuring of the way you go about your business on a day-to-day basis. And if we bear in mind how much of a change this has been, it is quite impressive that hundreds of thousands of companies up and down the country have been adapting in one way or another to the new situation.
Why do you think it is that we're not all marveling at this innovation and entrepreneurial spirit? I mean, do you think our culture isn't appreciative enough of the ingenuity that these employers are showing by adapting so quickly? I mean, like you say, it's not easy to re-engineer your business model overnight with absolutely no warning. And yet things like restaurants turning into farm shops, pubs making hand sanitizer, we're taking that sort of thing for granted, aren't we?
Yes, absolutely. That is the reason why I wrote that article. I think the reason why we're not noticing it particularly is simply that it doesn't fit into the spirit of the age. The general mood is very anti-capitalist, very anti-market. That's true on the political left of the spectrum anyway. The mainstream left has embraced socialism and has abandoned the sort of relatively market-friendly social democracy that they were previously comfortable with. And we see it on the political right as well, with an anti-liberal communitarianism replacing the sort of pro-market liberal conservatism that we saw before. So it's happening across the political spectrum. And it's because of that we tend to downplay or just not notice things that don't fit into this pattern. We notice the negatives of a market-based economy, actual or perceived, but just take the positive sides for granted. When I wrote this article, I was initially just looking for stories of how businesses were coping with the situation. I was not specifically looking for positive examples. I was just looking for examples of how various sectors are coping or not, or failing to cope. And I noticed I found lots of stories about price gouging, things about supermarket shortages from the early days of the lockdown, and things like that. But nobody was talking about these positive examples of entrepreneurship, of quick adaptability. These are all examples that I just, or anecdotes that I was just digging out from fairly obscure sources. This wasn't something that was getting a lot of traction, a lot of attention. And I think this is symptomatic of the anti-capitalist spirit of the age. Over the past 2 years or so, I've given lots of presentations on the return of socialism as a mainstream ideology. And one of the recurring reactions has been that whenever I talk about this in the Q&A sessions, there's always someone in the audience who stands up and says, well, if your capitalism was as brilliant as you claim it is, surely this wouldn't be happening. Surely this socialist revival is all just a legitimate response to the failings of capitalism. And if capitalism was delivering, this wouldn't be happening. And I don't accept that narrative at all. I think it's exactly the other way around. It's we start from an anti-capitalist perspective, and then we just, due to the dynamics of confirmation bias, we see lots and lots of things that seem to confirm those anti-market stereotypes. But when there are clear success stories of market-based entrepreneurship, we either take them for granted, or we just see them as something that would have happened anyway in any kind of system, something that has nothing to do specifically with markets or capitalism. And that is the way in which this anti-capitalist zeitgeist perpetuates itself.
So basically, people are seeing these kind of great examples of entrepreneurial spirit as happening despite the capitalist system, rather than actually they are allowed to happen because, you know, we don't live under socialism.
Yes, exactly. Imagine the Soviet Union still existed. How on earth would they have coped with the kind of economic transformation that we've been going through over the past 10 weeks or so? For them, this would have meant that their current five-year plan would have to be abandoned. They would have to say, okay, our entire five-year plan is now out of date because it's based on the idea that people can go to a factory or go to an office and work together in large groups. We have to suspend our current plan and come up with a completely new one. And in between, the economy would have been in a limbo. That kind of economy would never have been able to adapt to the current situation in the way that our economy has, almost without us noticing it.
Well, that's the point, isn't it? We're not able to celebrate these things quite as much as we should because we think, oh, well, you know, they've just happened, whereas actually we should be going, yes, and it's brilliant that they've happened. You know, this doesn't happen naturally. It only happens because we've got this system that allows it to do so. Do you think it's right? At the beginning, I mentioned that these businesses are sort of rays of light. After all, the economic picture is overwhelmingly negative. So, you know, is a few good businesses, you know, managing to scrape a new business model together, is that enough to make us optimistic about the future?
No. The overall picture is clearly negative. I absolutely don't want to downplay that or belittle that. The macroeconomic indicators at the moment are all extremely bleak, whether that's GDP figures or projections for the deficit, for unemployment. It all looks pretty grim right now, and I absolutely don't want to put a positive spin on that. I just want to point out that given how massive this disruption has been, it could have been a lot worse. And if we don't appreciate that, there is a danger that we draw the wrong policy conclusions. Because we have to remind ourselves of just how deep this economic transformation that we've been going through for the past 10 weeks or so has been, really. It's only a mild exaggeration to say that we have effectively created a completely different type of economy, namely what one commentator called it, a socially distanced economy. And I think that's the appropriate way of thinking about it. Until about 10 weeks ago, feels like a lifetime ago, the pre-corona age, most economic activity consisted of people going out and doing stuff.
Together.
Together, yes. Well. Yes, absolutely. Whether that's in our role as consumers, whether that meant going to a restaurant or a pub or a concert or on holiday, or whether that's in our role as producers, where economic activity mostly meant going to an office or some other kind of workplace and working with other people. Human contact has been an absolutely essential feature of most of our economic activity. And suddenly, from one day to the next, that wasn't there anymore. We suddenly had to construct an economy without that, without an element that was just essential to almost everything we did. And this is as if there was a law which suddenly said, from tomorrow on, nobody is allowed to use their right hand anymore. Or from tomorrow on, the English language is banned. And if you want to communicate, you have to find some other way of doing that. It's been an absolutely massive disruption. Most of what we considered normal economic activity 3 months ago was suddenly no longer available. We had to find a way of somehow making an economy work without being in close contact with one another. That's a massive disruption. Of course, we haven't managed to do that particularly well. Of course, this post-corona economy is smaller and less prosperous than the pre-corona economy. But given how much of a disruption this has been, I would say it could have been a lot worse.
In your article, you mentioned that many of the innovations or ways of working won't stick around after the pandemic and after lockdown restrictions have ended, which is to be expected because they've been designed to meet a need that hopefully, you know, in a few weeks or months won't be there anymore. Yeah. But how do you think we can make sure that the atmosphere that allowed these businesses to develop continues after coronavirus? I mean, we've seen a number of regulations scrapped or suspended, which, for example, allowed restaurants to pivot to takeaway food. Previously, that wasn't allowed. They'd have needed, you know, new permissions and that red tape and jumping over hurdles and so on. Do you think those regulations are going to creep back in? Or do you think we'll manage to hang on to this new sort of entrepreneurial spirit that allows businesses to take different steps?
It would require, I guess, somebody complaining about them. For now, they would just be the default option, and there's no specific reason to change that, but it could creep back in again if as soon as there are pressure groups arguing for that, because I don't think there would be much of a defense of the new situation. More generally, I would say we don't need a specific post-corona recovery plan. It's not that you need a completely different type of economic policy for a recovery. What constitutes good economic policy in normal times also constitutes good economic policy during a recovery phase. Our colleague Len Shackleton has written about this on the IEA blog. He had a piece where he talked about how after once this is all over, or once it starts to peter out, we need a post-corona Ludwig Erhard, an allusion to the West German Minister of Economic Affairs in the late 40s and 50s, who abolished a lot of controls and who was seen as the father of the post-war economic miracle. And I absolutely agree with him. I would just add to that Ludwig Erhard's policies didn't just make sense in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. This wasn't some sort of emergency program that you just do as a way to regain lost ground. It was something that made sense for a long time afterwards as well. And it is just generally good policy, a market-based policy, a flexible policy, making sure that businesses are free to adapt. That's and having undistorted market signals. These are things that make sense if you want to recover from a crisis. But these are also things that make sense during good times, when you just want to sustain a relatively successful economy. So it would just be that we have to do, make sure that businesses have the freedom to adapt, and make sure that if there has to be, for example, a recalibration with some sectors shrinking and others growing, which will probably happen, that we just have an economic structure that's flexible enough to do that. I think a big advantage for the British economy specifically will be that we have a relatively flexible labor market. That's why we will not see mass unemployment becoming entrenched in the way that some of the southern European economies might, but with much less flexible labor markets, where it's been the case that every time there's been a crisis, unemployment soars, and then it never quite falls back again to the pre-crisis level, or it stays that way for a very long time. I think that's something that we might be able to escape, with some exceptions. There is, of course, the rise in the minimum wage, which at the current time is really not a great idea, because what happened there was that the minimum wage then as a national policy was introduced at a time of a booming economy in the late 90s. At that time, there were people who were a bit overcautious, you know, critics of the policy, who said this is going to cause unemployment, and then the labor market situation continued to be very favorable. And since then, every warning about further increases in the minimum wage have been cast aside by saying, oh, well, you guys cried wolf in the late 90s. Therefore, by definition, you're always wrong. But just because you can have a relatively modest minimum wage in time in economically good times doesn't mean that you can just unlimitedly increase it all the time and in bad times as well. So that's something where we could see problems, the lower paid end of the labor market.
Right, that's great. Christian, thanks very much. And thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We hope that during these strange lockdown times, you'll have seen and enjoyed the IEA's significantly broader range of digital output, as we ourselves have taken advantage of the new situations being thrown up. It's not just this podcast, which you can subscribe to on Apple, Spotify and Podbean. Also on our YouTube channel, IEA London, we're posting new videos every single day with live discussion programmes and webinars several times a week. To help keep our content going, a contribution, no matter how modest, would be a huge help, and you can donate online at iea.org.uk. While you're there, you can sign up to the IEA's daily and Sunday newsletters to make sure you don't miss out on upcoming events and publications. Thanks very much for listening.